in all of the Disney stores. They have a laser that shoots down a very, you wouldn't see it. Like as customers, we wouldn't see it, but the employees know about it. They said, whenever somebody crosses that point, they know the likelihood of them to buy. They know the exact percentage of how likely they are to buy when they walk that deep into the store. I'm just like, that's crazy. Like, it's like a science to them. Like, right. That's how good they are at their process. They know if you pass that point, you're going to buy.
Welcome to the Next Big Pivot podcast. My name is Bernardo de la Vega, and through the process of building and selling 2 7-figure companies and launching a tech company, I became a big fan of entrepreneurs who pivot successfully. In this podcast, I'm going to be sharing with you the stories of founders and CEOs that made their big pivot so that you can learn why and how they did it. To learn more about the best way to pivot your business online, head over to thenextbigpivot.com. And we are back with another episode of The Next Big Pivot. Today on the show, we have an absolute sales rock star. And, you know, what I really like about Bilal is that basically, like, whenever he's on LinkedIn, he'll post, like, really, like, okay, here's how it is. Here's why people are doing it wrong. And here's how to do it right. And his advice is just, like, every post is, like really, really awesome advice and just like gold nuggets. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Bernardo. I appreciate the kind words, man. That's an honor.
Really excited to have you on here. I'm sure we'll learn a lot about sales. So can you start us off with, tell us a little bit of who you are and what you do?
Yeah. So my background is just startups. I've been a part of 7. One went IPO. One became a Fortune unicorn. One was acquired by LinkedIn. Probably 2 more will be acquired in the next 2 to 3 years, and then a couple of them flopped. So it's been a ride. I've had a good run overall. That's the world I know. So like inside sales and multiple startups have been the first sales hire. It's usually coming in very early on, you know, pre $1 million in revenue, and then usually at the point of around 15 or so $1 million in revenue, that's usually when I'm out and I go to the next thing.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. So why the need to like get out?
Okay. That's how much time do we have? I'm going to get like psychoanalyzed because, you know, I think the big reason for me is that when you do early on sales, which is typically called renaissance sales. So most sellers are coin operated sellers, meaning that they go into environments that are very predefined. Like if I go get a job at IBM or Oracle or Salesforce, there's not a ton of innovation happening there. You've got a territory, you've got a set of leads, you've got a sales process to train under and understand, and you go and you execute. And it's really a question of execution. But in the early days, when companies are not established and product market fit is still kind of forming, is not quite there, it's a lot more problem solving than traditional selling. I love that. I love the ambiguity. I love asking a founder a question and having them tell me, I don't know, go figure it out. Like, that's fun. The universe where there's more questions and answers and more to do than time to do it. That's fun because there's a lot of possibility there. And I find that the best challenge I could professionally was trying to solve those problems.
Ah, okay. So you say you love a challenge, right? And you, you know, especially when you ask a founder, I don't know, like you go figure it out. So, you know, sort of piggybacking on that, what are some of the things that you, you know, you face in sort of in your career where when exactly that has happened, right? When you like, you guys are kind of like in a startup mode, things are going well, and you're like, okay, we have this issue, and you're the one who actually went and figured it out, because it seems like you've been with a lot of startups and you're awesome at what you do.
Yeah, you know, I think the right mentality, I heard an entrepreneur once describe it like this: prototype to fail. And I think that applies regardless of whether you're an engineer or somebody who works product or in any other role, marketing, sales, operations, what have you. Prototype to fail. I want to get to the right answer is typically only a couple things, maybe only one thing. The wrong answer is many. So it's a lot easier to figure out what not to do than what to do when you're faced with overwhelming possibility and too many outcomes, right? Because our brains don't do very well in ambiguity. We don't like that. So when you're faced with too much ambiguity and there's a lot of possibility, it's easier to say, well, what should I not be doing? What's the thing that's the biggest waste of my time? And let me not do that. Avoid that at all costs.
Okay.
And let me pick one or two things, and I'm going to do it like with conviction, with full conviction for like 2 weeks. and have a concrete answer whether it works or not, instead of doing five things for 3 months and not being sure about any of them at the end of that 3 month period. Okay. So like a classic example of this is typically for many startups, they typically will do a direct sale approach, but there's the one to many sales, right? Partnerships, channel partners, big enterprise customers that could also be investors that have like dual purpose. You always find these great possibilities out there. And it's like, yeah, there'll be many of them for many startups. Mm-hmm. But the right way to approach that is like, okay, let's pick one solid example that we feel really good about. And let's work that partnership to death, right? Let's just go in full on that partnership. None of the others. We won't even have a conversation with the others. And we'll spend a month with them. Mm-hmm. And if at the end of a month, we don't have something concrete in terms of an agreement, you know, some memorandum of understanding, some referral business, something from them that shows that we're moving towards revenue, we drop it. We drop it. Mm-hmm. We go back to what we know works. And I think that's the sort of like prototype to fail mentality.
Mm. So really like really focusing on one avenue. And so again, going back to that, kind of like your scenario, can you tell us a like kind of like story about something that you figured out, you know, in like the sort of the multiple roles that, you know, whether it was kind of like, you know, how to grow or how to approach in terms of certain clients to really start growing the sales for that startup?
Yeah, I think I'll focus on channel partnerships because I think any entrepreneur that goes into business will have their investors making introductions for these sort of things. We'll see these possibilities with other companies that they think to themselves, man, if I could just win them over, all of their clients are perfect clients of mine. That's a really classic thing that happens at most startups.
We're exactly right there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But the problem is if you approach that company or that partner or whatever it is with that mentality, you will fail. Like that's the guaranteed method to fail because there's nothing in it for them. Like, right. So what that you care about my clients? You're not bringing me anything of value by just wanting them. And this whole idea of like, well, we'll do a kickback. That's the classic thing. We'll do a kickback. We'll give you a referral fee. Can we make it worth your time? But people don't make decisions like that. They don't open up their book of business. They don't bring you into their universe because of cash. It's not pay to play. Right. Very few things are. There's a very rare, sometimes like enterprise companies will have a pay to play channel partnership program, but oftentimes it's about relationships. It's about emotional connection, right? You prove to me that you're a trustworthy person that I want to do business with and that you can make me look good. And if you do that, I will totally introduce people to you.
Right.
And I think that's the big thing that entrepreneurs will not sit down and really think about when they want to do a successful channel or partnership program is say to themselves, how am I going to front load a bunch of value to them without asking for anything back, which is risky. But how am I going to do that knowing that there's a prize at the end of the tunnel, right? There's something waiting for me if I can deliver for them. And that might look like giving them material that they can send to their customers. That's going to be of value, right? You go out there and do a white paper for them. Mm-hmm. You go in and put in the time and effort, and it just makes them look good. That's a great way to win people over.
Right.
Do work for them. Another thing might be you personally go sell to their clients and then have them talk to the partner about you, right? So you go and do the work and show them your clients do care about this. I went and did the effort for you. You're not guessing here. I've got 7, 8, 10, 12 of your clients already saying, they want me to work with you, right? Mm-hmm. That takes time to establish those ways. So these are the methods that you would use to really create a successful channel or partnership program early on as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, no, and that's, you know, like I said, like that's where we are. And I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it because in fact, like I actually did that last week. They were still interested, but I was like, it didn't go so well, right? I was like, oh, I think it could have gone better. So yeah, no, great point. So as we move forward into kind of like, you know, some of the, like your sales, would really like to get into kind of like the meat and potatoes of what your expertise is. And so, you know, looking at what you do, what's something that, you know, you think that everybody in the space either should stop doing or should start doing, right? They're like, okay, almost everybody's doing this wrong, or almost everybody should really start doing this because what they're doing is just not working.
So I'll give you one of each because they tie together.
Okay.
Can I do that? Is that all right?
Yeah, okay. That sounds good. Yeah.
So here's what everyone should be doing.
Okay.
And here's what they, and then here's what they need to stop doing. So I'll start with what they should be doing. So this is something that took me years to learn, but the buyer's journey is universal. Whether it's a stick of gum, a house, a piece of software, people buy using the same five steps. They go from unaware to aware to consideration, evaluation, decision. Those are the five stages of the buyer's journey. Whatever your product is, map your selling process to those five stages. This is a classic example of companies failing to do this. I ask for a meeting, sending an email for the first time to somebody I think should buy from me.
Mm-hmm.
That makes no sense. That person is unaware I even exist.
Right.
They have no clue what my product is.
Right.
And I'm asking them for a meeting and the first message to them. I have to take them from unaware to aware before I can even judge whether they're willing to consider my product to make an evaluation and a decision, right?
Mm-hmm.
The only people you need to be meeting with are people who are considering your product, not people who are unaware you even exist, right? So when you respect the stages, you find that the messaging, the call to actions, the outcomes, the desired outcomes that you're looking for align much better to the mindset of the person you're prospecting to. If they've never heard of me, I don't need to tell them about how great my product is as if they're evaluating it.
Right.
Doesn't make sense. So that ties into the thing people need to stop doing, which is I was taught something called the is, does, means messaging pyramid.
Uh-huh.
It is at the bottom, does in the middle, means at the top. So what is your product? What does it do? And what does it mean?
Right.
And I think B2B gets this horribly wrong. B2C, for some reason, has figured it out much better. So a classic example of this is Snickers, the chocolate bar, right? Mm-hmm. What is Snickers? It's a chocolate bar. That's what it is, right? What does it do? It fills you up. It's, you know, they've got the peanut butter in there, the chocolate nougat. It's very tasty. It's a very heavy bar. But what does it mean? Do they show you an ad of a chocolate bar when you watch Snickers on TV? No. They always say it's an ad of, like, for example, a group of friends. One of the friends is hungry, so they're being whiny and they're being annoying. And then another friend hands them a Snickers bar. And then the ad says, you're not you when you're hungry.
Mm.
They're telling you what it means to be hungry and how annoying you sound and how when you're in a situation like that, you're not going to go get a meal. It's just easier just to eat a Snickers bar. And on the Snickers bar, they write one word only, Snickers satisfies. That's marketing about what it means to use their product.
Right.
A lot of companies, when you go to their website, they're basically saying, I'm a chocolate bar, which is not very helpful, right? They're saying what it is that they do. Sometimes they talk about what it does. Very rarely do B2B brands or entrepreneurs, even in general, when they're messaging about their product, talk about what it means to use their product. So that's what people need to stop doing, is they need to stop advertising their chocolate bar. They need to start talking about Snickers satisfies, that kind of mentality. You're not you when you're hungry. That's the sort of messaging you need to start doing. And that aligns really well with the buyer's journey.
Okay. No, that's super interesting. Now that you said that, I'm like, I think our messaging on our website, we might be kind of like falling into that trap as well.
It happens very easily. It's a curse of knowledge because you intimately know your product so well.
Right.
It's very hard for you to take a step away from it and be like, well, if I never heard of this before, what would I need to know?
Right.
Right. What would I actually, what's the bare bones minimum I need to know?
And I agree. And that's what I tell everybody. Like when people that I work with, I'm like, here, like you need to assume. And like to the biggest people who are responsible for this is developers, right? Mm-hmm. Developers always do things based on, if this happens, then they just do this and this. And I'm like, no, like you are a developer. We're coding for, you know, especially like if creating an app for either like podcasts or the average user, most people are actually like, you know, way, way less technologically literate than you. And so developers are like the perfect case.
Great example.
Because they're just like, yeah, of course, you just do this and this and this. I'm like, no.
You're like, no.
Yeah, no. Yeah, yeah.
People don't know how to code.
Yeah.
They don't think that way.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. People don't know how to code. And they don't know, like, most people don't start troubleshooting. And they're like, oh, yeah, because you troubleshoot. Like, no. Right. Like super easy. So, you know, I agree. So definitely like issue with B2B, definitely issue with sort of developers on that. So, you know, that then, but as you're saying that, so then what is the solution to that? And I know kind of like you touched upon it, but what is the way to really solve that problem?
So this is the like the tactical way when you're thinking about your messaging, when you're writing an email, right, to somebody who you want to buy from you, mm-hmm. when you're thinking about the copy on your marketing page, when you're doing all these things, there's a couple questions you have to answer. And if you find yourself answering these questions wrong, you fell into the trap, get out. All right. If you're answering these questions right, proceed because you're doing it correctly. One question you need to ask yourself is who's the hero? Who's the hero? When you write bad copy, you're the hero, right? So for example, I say to you, Bernardo, I wanted to email you about my company. I did some research on you. We're the number one, and all of a sudden, right, I'm just going into what my company does. That's classic bad messaging because you don't care. Again, you're unaware that I exist. You never expressed any interest in what I do. And I'm messaging you as though you were evaluating my product and telling you why I'm so good. It's all about me. Horrible messaging. A better example would be like, Bernardo, you know what sucks? Trying to tell your developers that the people who are going to use your app are not as technologically literate as them. Have you ever had that happen to you? That's all about you, right? Nothing about what I sell or what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And if you're my ideal customer, you'll be nodding your head up and down like, yeah, I hate that. And if you're not my ideal customer, you're going to read that message and be like, no, that's never happened to me. And both is great because the last thing I want to do is try to sell somebody who's not going to buy. Mm-hmm. And what I want to do is the people who will buy from me to immediately acknowledge and understand that I'm talking their language. I'm talking their problems. I'm talking their world. And again, like when you go back to that Snickers ad, like B2C brands have figured this out. Like Apple, another great example. Their ads are nothing about computers, are nothing about phones. Their ads are about their brand. The last Apple ad I saw on TV was a movie that was shot on an iPhone. That's what it was. They were just mm-hmm. showing a really cool movie. And at the bottom of the screen, it said shot on an iPhone and then the Apple icon. And that was the end of the ad. It had nothing to do with the features of the phone, the products, the pricing, nothing. Because if you love Apple, you feel already an affinity to their brand. Right. And when you see that, that makes you want to buy their product.
Right.
Right. So that's what, you know, that's all about what you can do as a user with their phone, right? What it means to you. So that's the first question. When you're writing copy, when you're trying to sell someone, when you're writing a cold email or a cold call or whatever, who's the hero? Are you making the person who's supposed to buy the hero? Or are you making yourself the hero?
Right.
So that's a big one. And it's a hard one. But it's a difference between my product, my company, this is what we do, or have you ever, what's your experience with, don't you hate when, and I'm talking about your world.
Mm-hmm.
The other big thing that will help you avoid these pitfalls of bad messaging is, again, knowing what stage that person is in. There's two words that get mixed up in sales very often, prospect and buyer. People think they're synonyms, they're not, okay? People who are unaware that your product exists today, or maybe have some slight awareness but never express any interest, they're prospects. They're as good as a cold lead in a CRM. Worth it. So what, you've got my email. So what, you've got my phone number saved in your CRM. That's not money. You haven't turned me into anything yet. That's a prospect. A buyer is somebody who shows intent. Mm-hmm. And a buyer does things that a seller can't control, but needs them to do. Let me give you an example of something a buyer needs to do that a seller can't control. Mm-hmm. I need my buyers to think about their budget, right? They need to have some plan of how they're going to make this purchase. Is it going to be on a credit card? Are they going to have to meet with their boss? Is there an executive committee they have to go to? That's something they have to do. I can tell them the price. I can tell them why they should buy it. But at the end of the day, I need them to mobilize internally, think about the money, and come up with it. Another mm-hmm. example, I need them to have a critical event. Is their current contract about to expire? So they're looking for a new vendor. Do they have a major project like a website redesign that's going to end at the end of the month that they need to prepare for? There has to be some sort of critical event in the world of the buyer that's happening that they've told me about. Otherwise, if they don't have a critical event, very high odds my deal ends in no decision and stalls out. And they'll ghost me, right? The classic ghosting. I was talking to them. It seemed great. They didn't really have any need at the moment, but they were excited about it. Then, you know, 3 months later, I can't get a word from them. I don't know what happened because they had no critical event. There was no urgency on their side, right? You as a seller, you as an entrepreneur trying to get them to buy, you need to identify that. I have to say to you, Bernardo, what's your critical event? What's driving this conversation? If you tell me nothing, Birena, I was just checking it out. I bet, great. In my head, I'm like, okay, then he's a window shopper. I'll show him some cool things, but I'm not going to mark him as a buyer because he's still just aware of my product. He's not considering it. He hasn't shown me intent. So I'll treat him that way. Right. I'll be, cool, Bernard, I'll show you a few things today that might pique your interest. And then when you're ready, you can come back to me. Instead of thinking about you and trying to sell you and then trying to convince you, which is a big waste of time.
Right.
So I think those are the two major things, right? Getting the messaging right so that you're not the hero, the buyer is the hero, right? The person you're messaging to feels like they're the hero. And making sure that you understand that a buyer shows intent and they have to come, you know, it's a relationship. They have to come with their side of it too. Because if they're not talking about budget, they're not thinking about critical events, they're not defining the impact of what the product will be for them, you don't really have a buyer then. You're not going to close that deal.
Wow, that was awesome. That was awesome. Yeah, yeah. You know, and you're so right about, you know, when you talk about sort of the critical event, is there a way, you know, and I actually like, so for me, so going back, I did door-to-door sales when I was in college. So I sold books door-to-door.
Bless you, by the way. That's the hardest sales on the planet.
That is the hardest thing. Like, any business I've ever done, you're like, oh, must be really hard to be an entrepreneur, this online business, figuring it out. Like,
door-to-door sales.
It compares to, and I was doing that 10, 12 hours a day. We would do 80 hours a week, Monday through Saturday night, 80 hours a week, knocking on doors.
That's insane.
Crazy. Yeah, yeah.
You were like, literally...
crazy. Yeah, absolutely. And so like they would say, okay, you know, we had to always, you know, try to work on the things we can control, but definitely we always say, okay, find the buyers. And really like, you know, like the whole thing was, okay, in the first 2 minutes or even sometimes less, you'd identify, okay, this person is going to buy or not. And if not, do not spend, because they were like, the worst thing draining is to spend 30 minutes with a non-buyer. Yeah. It's not that so much you waste your time, but it just drains your energy, right? Because you just spent so much time. But if you get really good at that, like you said, of like identifying your buyers and your non-buyers, you can just move on. And then you're like, you're from an emotional level, you're kind of like unfazed because you only spent 2 minutes on that person.
You feel like control. You feel control because you're like, I controlled that.
Right.
I agree. Yeah, I know. It's a horrible feeling. And door-to-door sales, 80 hours a day. Bless you, man.
Yeah, that was
insane.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It was so hard. But the second summer, I won Man of the Year. So like I had this massive sort of anger. But I will say my first summer, the first 3 weeks, I didn't sell a single book. And I had like the worst start ever. And then I like really, really picked up. But because I actually came from Mexico, I started doing this with like speaking English like 50%. So I couldn't even speak it fluently. Anyway, kind of a crazy story. But going back to what you're talking about, in terms of the, like identifying this critical event, is there a way to really kind of like milk this or like really bring out of them? Because, you know, one of the things that we learned was like, okay, you really need to like identify the need, right? Because they're like, okay, you know, like, are you, and we ask them all these questions of like, okay, do you have a hard time with school? That's kind of one. But it was more like, okay, we paint a picture, like, do you come home from school and everybody's really tired and like Tim still has 3 hours worth of homework and he can't concentrate and he's doing all these things. And this was when there was obviously no iPhones. This was back in 2008. But like we really try to like create this like a story and try to really like paint like, okay, this is yes. Like Tuesday at 9 p.m. still have 2 more hours worth of homework. Timmy doesn't want to do any more homework, that kind of stuff. So for you, do you try to really like paint a picture or not so much? Or how do you do that for B2B?
A great, great question. Let me say this first. There's no place for shyness in sales.
Right.
So if you're going to, you know, I'm just letting the entrepreneurs that are listening to this, if you feel shy about asking the tough questions, you're going to get your time wasted.
Mm-hmm.
The buyer doesn't owe you anything. They're right. going to ghost you. They're going to leave you on a cliffhanger,
right.
biting your nails, wishing you could have and should have and would have. That's just how it is. That's the right. nature of sales. There's no shyness in sales. You have to ask those questions. You need to ask them up front. I mean, literally, you can tell the person like, so here's what we've seen on the people who buy from us and the people who don't. Mm-hmm. People who don't buy from us typically fall into this camp. Dot, 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 X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3. People right. who buy from us typically fall in this camp. X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3. The difference that we've seen is, and then you try to, you make a polarizing statement. You take a stance, right? We think that X. We think that I advise a startup, I'll give you a real practical example. I advise a startup that was a healthcare data management and as well as analytics. And what they were doing was they were trying to help medical directors get off of Excel and into making decisions based on big data. Because at many of the health plans in the US, they still use pivot tables in Excel to analyze data. So okay. I was like, okay, let's be provocative. Let's make a statement. Let's decide who's in and who's not. Okay. So the statement we're going to make is, we don't think that the modern health professional in the year of 2020 should be using the same tools a high school student uses for their science fair project.
Okay.
Bold statement, right? And then there's a whole group of people who are like, no, right?
Right.
Excel is great. Pivot tables are pretty powerful. I don't think you know, I don't think it's like that. But there's a whole other side that we're like, yeah, you're right. I mean, as a medical professional in the year of 2020, it's kind of silly that I use the same tool, you know, a university student or a high school student would use to do basic mathematics.
Right.
That doesn't make sense. You're right. And then we said that we think there's a better way. Would you be interested in seeing it? Right. Mm-hmm. So you make a statement and then you drive into the critical event. Now, what would make you switch? Right. Because what we've seen is the people who aren't willing to switch have these characteristics. The people who are willing to switch typically think like this.
Right.
What do you think? Without any judgment, right? I'm not trying to lead you into one or the other. I'm genuinely asking you, where do you see yourself? Because if you're here, I have something really great to show you. Mm-hmm. If you're here, thank you very much for your time and I wish you the best of luck.
Right.
And I think that's like, again, getting away from shyness, just being real. Like you said, you would ask those questions early in the conversation. Within 2 minutes, you knew, do I have a buyer or not? That's the hallmark of a great seller. Because you knew the pattern of your buyer.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine you just put that on your prospects and be like, you tell me now where you stand. And I think great marketing and sales copy does that. It polarizes people. Just like the most famous ad in TV history was that Apple ad that they did on that like 1984 thing, right? Mm-hmm. Back in the day. And they played it in the Olympics and they got all that and they won an award for it and all that. It was a polarizing ad because it was like, it was kind of like mocking the modern day technology at that time.
Right.
And it followed Steve Jobs later on doing that big presentation that he did when the iPhone did come out, when he made fun of all the other phones that were out there.
Right.
That stuff works because he polarized the audience. He made people pick a side. And since then, that company has multiple times become the most valuable company in the world. Right now, they're probably not, but they were only like 3-4 years ago. So, and that's the way. And I think as entrepreneurs, as sellers, as marketers, that's very easy to copy in a B2B setting.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. So within this process that you're talking about, what are some of the things that for somebody who's getting into B2B, like what is their first step? You know, you talked about all the sort of the different process, but like, I'm sure with all your experience as you're coaching certain people, like what's the first thing that people who are getting into sales or that are not doing so well in sort of a B2B sales, what's kind of like one or two first steps that they can take, like super actionable, super tactical steps? So like, okay, like if I can just at least focus on these one or two things, because when you explain the whole thing, it makes sense. But sometimes it's like, okay, I understand the concept, but how do I actually like put this into practice and just start with like one or two things?
It is very complicated. It's a whole thing. And I'm talking from, again, curse of knowledge, right. 10 years of experience only doing this.
Right. Yeah. So
your first year, it might make sense. Then you go back to your computer and you're like, what the hell?
And you keep doing the same thing, right? Yeah. You're like, I understand at high level, but I'm still like, right.
Yeah. I'd say so tactically, one thing that everybody should do, and there's a bunch of great resources on the internet. You don't need to take a course for this. This is a simple Google search. How to create your ideal customer profile, called ICP. Everybody who can buy your product is not everybody who should be buying your product. There's a big difference between can and should. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is a classic mistake that entrepreneurs do when they size up their market. They're like, oh, our market is this big. And it's like, no, it's not. Your market's only a fraction of that. And that's okay. But everybody who can use your product isn't going to. There's only a very small portion that should and will. So your target addressable market is everybody who can use your product. Your ideal customer profile is everybody who should be doing it, right? Everybody who needs to be using it. And that is a very clearly defined profile. And those are the people you sell to. They have things like, think about it like this. Any sort of entrepreneur is typically dealing with a market that doesn't know they exist. So who do you need to find to sell in that market? You need early stage adopters of technology, people who try new things. The last thing you need to do is spend your time with people like my cousin. My cousin has an AOL email. I swear. He still has an AOL email. Not
early adopter.
Not an early adopter of technology. I mean, I'm like, not even like a Yahoo email or like.
I know.
Like you're like.
Yahoo is like.
But, you're like 15 years back, man. Like you're crazy. Yeah. Like you don't go to him and try to sell your new widget or your new piece of technology. He's not the guy.
Yeah.
You know, he works in insurance. He has an AOL email. He plays it safe. He doesn't change.
Yep.
He might be somebody who could use your product, but he's not somebody who will.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the difference between your ideal customer profile and a target addressable market. Your ideal customer profile are people who are like early stage adopters of the technology. They have clearly defined critical events. They have really specific criteria. Like, be specific. The whole point of the ICP is to limit your focus. Be narrow. It's okay. Don't get that fear of missing out that like, oh, I'm cutting too much of my market down. No, it's a good thing, because those are the people who typically buy fast, buy a lot, and come back for more. That's right. Who your ideal customer is. So I'd say ICP is one thing to really narrow down. That's a tactical step. If you don't have an ICP card or an ICP document internally that everybody has agreed upon, that everybody understands, that everybody can recite back to you, then you're missing focus. You're missing marketing focus. You're missing sales focus, and you're going to waste time because not everybody's on the same page. The other really big thing is going back to the universal buyer's journey. Like go back through your messaging and really tell yourself there's five stages. Let me map what it takes to go through these five stages in my product. How do I take somebody who's never heard of what I sold before to knowing just being aware that I exist?
Right.
Then how do I take them from being aware that I exist to judging or measuring if they're willing to consider using it? And then if they're considering it, what would it take to make them evaluate it? Those critical events, defining impact, knowing the budget. Mm-hmm. And then who are the people that have evaluated my product that made a decision to buy?
Right.
You map those stages. I mean, you literally like you put those five stages on a whiteboard and you write underneath it exactly what a prospect would have to do to become a customer. How do I go from prospect to buyer to customer?
Mm.
You do that exercise, and that could be a multi-day exercise with your team. And then you go and you look at your sales copy, your marketing copy, your website, and all that stuff. And then you put it back to that and you'd be like, are we doing the right thing? Are we talking to people as if they're unaware of our product? Or are we talking to them as if they're making a decision?
Right.
You will find gaps, guaranteed. Because once you have a concrete process like that and you adhere to the process, right, you will get consistency. You will start seeing consistency in your pipe, in your conversion, in your revenue, because you know that you can get predictability because you're following a process that you've mapped very clearly.
Mm. That was so good. So good in terms of sort of like mapping the whole the whole journey and really understanding, like you said, like really understanding where your buyer is at, right? And really tweaking your message. You know, that's also something that, you know, sort of you do with D2C, right? Like, you know, like as you do your ads, like, you know, sort of like making sure that every stage of the funnel, you're targeting. So, you know, like you said, with B2B, it seems like you also really do that and really identifying kind of like those stages for sure.
Yeah. Companies have been doing this for years. We're B2B is actually kind of behind. Like okay. I met with a senior executive at Disney a few years back, and he told me that they're so precise in what they do that they actually have a laser in all of the Disney stores. This is before the pandemic and everything, when the stores and the amusement parks were all open still. They have a laser that shoots down you wouldn't see it. Like as customers, we wouldn't see it, but the employees know about it. They said, whenever somebody crosses that point, that breaks that laser point, they know the likelihood of them to buy. They know the exact percentage of how likely they are to buy when they walk that deep into the store. I'm just like, that's crazy. Like it's like a science to them. Like right. That's how good they are at their process. They know if you pass that point, you're going to buy. And that's when an associate will come help you. Like wild. Like brands have been doing this for a very long time. Another example is like back when malls used to be open, a lot of the major clothing brands, they release different smells in the store. Mm-hmm. Because there's been a bunch of research that shows different smells increase the likelihood of us to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So like clothing brands like Abercrombie and Fitch and H&M and all those sort of stores, they typically release smells into the store that increase your likelihood to buy. I mean, it's a science, right? They're not playing games.
Right.
They're playing psychology. And then you go to like a B2B brand and they don't even have their buyer's journey mapped. And you're like, what are you guys doing? This is amateur hour. Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Get on point. You got to know how people buy.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And so you say sort of in the B2B space, most of the companies don't really sort of like understand this process. But I mean, obviously from the D2C space, you know, obviously the ones you're mentioning are the obviously really, really big ones, right? That have these massive teams. Within everything that you're doing, do you feel then that for you, what is the next big thing that you're sort of like you're working on, right? Because you obviously have like this really awesome sort of view. Like, is it just, you know, continue to work in the sort of the, like these in the B2B space, obviously you have your own company, but what's kind of like, what's your next kind of like growth step as you look at all your experience and where you're like, okay, we're really going after this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not even sure. I think.
Well, question though, is there a reason? So with all these startups that you've done, right?
Yeah.
Like, have you not said, okay, let me start my own startup, which kind of, but like going to like a tech startup and be like, okay, with everything that I know, let me do a tech startup and let me go to all the way to, you know, like 100 million or, you know, 500 million and go it all the way because I've done this so many times. Has that never sort of crossed?
It has, but like entrepreneurship is like crazy. you know, it's crazy. Like having worked with so many founders and in some cases sold to founders in a couple of different startups, like the stats are against you, right? Like what is it? Anywhere from 90 to 98%, depending on what statistic you use, of startups fail. It's a very hard road. I one of the founders that I work with once said to me, the hardest decision is deciding to go into business. It's the hardest decision. Everything after that is just trying to make it not fail.
Okay.
That's it. And I was like, yeah, I can imagine so. So being so intimate and seeing the process so many times over, I know how hard it can be. And part of me is just like, it's kind of easier just to jump on somebody else's spaceship and blast off than to try to build my own. But it definitely has crossed my mind. But I also think about like, the good news is there's enough people trying to be entrepreneurs in the world.
Right.
And the reality is many of them have technical or typically like industry experience, which is why they see a problem that they can solve.
Mm-hmm.
Few of them have business acumen, have like marketing or sales experience.
Right.
Right. Like, then we were talking about like a developer. So many developers will find great ways to make a new program, a new product, a new offering that they know can solve a particular need. But like the best product doesn't win. Like that's the cold, hard truth. Right. If it did, we wouldn't see such like shitty products in the world. The best sales and marketing wins.
Yeah.
The best sales and marketing wins every time. Like there are many, many brands that shouldn't be where they are because the quality is not there, but the sales and marketing is.
Right.
The sales and marketing is. So I think about my superpower is copywriting. That's like my superpower. And so for me, it's like I could do my own business where I write my own copy, or I can help 1,000 businesses with their copy.
Okay. But, so, but I mean, yes, but like, you know, from a, let's just talk really like money perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, obviously sort of the, I'm sure like, sort of like each gig pays very well, you know, obviously with your experience, but being part of that, that is kind of like that, that founding team, isn't that, you know, financially like could be a lot more rewarding again, if you, if you're on the right boat, right? Kind of thing.
It could be.
Could be.
But odds are it's not.
Ah, okay. You're playing the odds.
Odds are it's not. And like I take advisory roles, usually advise anywhere from 3 to 10 startups at a time.
Okay.
And I'll take equity. You know, I'll take like 0.25% or, you know, 0.5% or something like that, equity. Right. And it's like, yeah, okay, if you know, then you pull out your calculator, you're like, okay, well, if they sold for, if they sold for $250 million, wow, that's a great paycheck. But I'm like, yeah, if.
Right.
If. How many startups sell for $250 million, right? Like,
right,
it doesn't happen. So, but the thing is, you're right. Like the entrepreneurial spirit, for sure. Like I love startups. That's all I know. I will never work for like an IBM or Oracle. It just wouldn't happen. I would not be comfortable there. I like the ambiguity. I like the change. I like, that's why you and I connected so quickly. I'm like, oh, he's a startup guy. I can tell. Startup people know each other. We get each other.
Yeah.
So I that's my world and I'll always love it. Maybe one day I'll take the chance, but I think right now I'm good. I'm good riding other people's rocket ships.
Right. For sure. Well, Bill, this has been awesome. Thank you so much. Great having you on the show. I mean, we could keep going on forever and ever, but you know, we'd love to have you, you know, in a few months as things start ramping up for us. But yeah, thank you so much. Obviously, don't go away. Want to sort of connect with you a little bit, but thank you so much for being on the show. If people want to know more about what you do, connect with you, find out, you know, and obviously, like, you know, hire you for some of your awesome copywriting and sales experience and customer journeys and ICPs, where can they find you?
Yeah, great question. First off, thanks for having me, by the way. It's my honor. I really appreciate it. So on LinkedIn, I'm there posting every day, like tactical sales advice. So there's a lot of great stuff to find there and you can message me there. The other way is I have a sales community. It's free, deathtofluff.bravado.co. Mm-hmm. I think we're over 900 something people in there. It's entrepreneurs and managers and salespeople and everything that just want to do it differently. I have a bunch of content in there as well. A lot of stuff I do on LinkedIn, I'll add to it and give that to the community. So that's another great place. And that's on my LinkedIn profile. So if people want an easy way to get to that website, it's right there on my LinkedIn.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. This was awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Next Big Pivot podcast. Don't forget to click that subscribe button. Check out the Fiesta app where you will find some amazing breakthrough pivots and aha moments in just 30 seconds of pure awesomeness from some of the best podcasts out there, or just say, Alexa, play Fiesta podcast clips. You can visit our website at fiesta.app or download the app on iOS or Android, where you can record your podcast with studio quality, create and distribute 30-second video highlights, and reach 100 million households with the Alexa Skill app. See you guys on the next episode, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast.